It's Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu was in Wauwatosa earlier today to promote the Biden administration's investment in Wisconsin's clean energy sector, particularly electric vehicle chargers. Wisconsin will be receiving $17 million of federal funding for more charging stations, some of which are manufactured in Milwaukee. And the state Senate this week passed a bill that would free up almost $80 million in federal money to help businesses install electric vehicle chargers. Those funds are part of what the White House says will be $4 billion of money going toward green energy in Wisconsin over the next 6 years. With that, the administration will come new jobs. Julie Hsu is the acting U.S. Secretary of Labor. She was also born in Madison. She talked with Central Time executive producer Dean Knetter earlier today.
You were at the Milwaukee Electrical Training Center in Wauwatosa today talking about federal investment in electrical vehicle charging stations and the green energy sector. What's happening at that training center that made you want to highlight it?
That's right. So we're investing in a workforce system that will connect people to the good jobs that are coming to Milwaukee and employers to the people that they need. And that training is happening right here through a partnership between employers and unions, which we see as the best way to make sure that we can fill all the good jobs that are coming through the president's Investing in America agenda.
And what kind of jobs are tied to that investment? What's under that umbrella?
Today's announcement is about electric vehicle charging stations, and this is part of the unprecedented investments that the president has led in ensuring our clean climate future. It's also about infrastructure, right? It's about roads and bridges, and also how when someone's driving down that road in an electric vehicle, they can have a reliable way of making sure that they can get from point A to point B. And so for us, we know, and this president has said time and time again, that we make investments in things, in roads, in bridges, in high-speed internet, in clean air and drinking water. It's not just about making things. It's about creating good jobs, especially in communities that have been left out in the past. So we were here to talk about building that infrastructure.
And when a company gets federal investment to build something like an electric vehicle charging station or whatever it might be, and they expand, hopefully hire more people, what does the Labor Department do to make sure those are good jobs, like you said, that they have good pay benefits and that they stick around?
That's exactly right. So when we are putting out federal funding, federal investments, we are looking for employers, for partners who know that the best way to create the most secure outcomes is to invest in your workforce. It's also the best way to attract the most talented workers in this tight labor market that we're in. And so the Department of Labor's investments, today there was an announcement of $1.5 million to the Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership. But before today, the Department of Labor had already invested $3.2 million into WRTP Big Step. And that's because we know that infrastructure isn't built overnight, right? We need to lay the foundation, and we're doing that right here in Milwaukee and across Wisconsin to really meet this moment. So our investments are in workforce training programs done right, and that's through partnerships between employers, unions, community-based organizations, and local leadership.
I know for some people out there, hearing that investment is coming and bringing new green energy jobs with it sounds like a bit of a common refrain from politicians. For those listening skeptical right now, what can you point to in Wisconsin and say, hey, this job creation is actually happening here?
So that's the great thing, right? Today's investment is in a program that already has proven results. Today, we heard from several people who had graduated from programs already run by the WRTP Big Step and are now electricians. They're building the future in their own communities. And these are jobs that don't require a college degree. And so today I also met with many students who are, going to get their high school diploma and get the skills they need to get to a job. Now, the other thing is, across Wisconsin, the Biden-Harris administration has made about $2.8 billion in funding for 182 infrastructure projects all across Wisconsin. And that's about transportation. It's also about access to clean water. So we have seen projects begin, but in this next year, in 2024, we are really, really going to see them take off. And at the time that a project begins, it's too late to begin training, right? Which is why we're here right now talking about the training infrastructure that's going to be needed to make sure that once the shovel hits the ground, the people are ready to do the work.
And I know there's more money still slated to come into the energy sector from the Inflation Reduction Act. And there is a sense here in Wisconsin that, you know, opportunity, money, growth flows into Madison and some areas of Milwaukee and its suburbs. Can you say that other areas of Wisconsin are going to see the benefits of this, maybe those jobs?
No question about it. So part of this is because with President Biden's leadership, just the pure amount of investments are like we've never seen them like this before, right? So it's the federal investments, but it's also because, you know, instead of, you know, exporting jobs and importing products, we're actually investing in industry here in the United States, right? Having manufacturing jobs, having infrastructure and construction jobs, having clean energy jobs done here. We're also seeing more private investments. And so companies have committed over $4 billion in private sector investments all across Wisconsin since President Biden took office. So all of these, you know, I understand the anxiety, and I know that people, you know, sitting at their kitchen table or driving now and listening to NPR want to know that it's going to make a real difference. And that is why I'm here. That's why I'm in Milwaukee, so that every community understands that we intend these investments to really make a difference for those families. And we've seen them start already to the tune of billions of dollars. But as you already said, there is more to come, and 2024 is going to be a really big year.
And before we let you go, Secretary Sue, I just wanted to broaden out and touch on wages more generally. We hear from people a lot who call in and, you know, have a job, but it doesn't pay quite enough to really feel like they're getting ahead. I think that's a common sentiment out there. What are you focusing on when it comes to wages and how to stimulate wage growth?
Right. So again, President Biden has made very clear that when we invest in workers in this country, America is stronger, right? And we're not going to build a future in which workers get left behind. And so just at the high level, we have seen, right, record low levels of unemployment, which means along with high levels of labor force participation, meaning people want to work and they're finding jobs. And the other thing we've seen is real wage growth, especially for low and middle income Americans. Now, your point, though, about people feeling it, right? We also are continuing to battle high prices, right, which is, you know, really how people feel the economy most directly. The president has said that he wakes up every day, and we're all working to fight against that. But just, you know, the cost of things is one side of the equation. The other, as you're noting, is what people make. And so when you have good jobs in fixing a road, in, you know, like we're here today talking about electricians. These are jobs that pay a middle-class wage. And that investment is also creating, it's creating higher wages in other sectors too, because in a tight labor market, employers need to compete for workers. And we all see these as good things in an economy that does right by workers. So we want workers to make a decent wage so that they can support their families without having to work, multiple jobs. That is fundamental to the president's economic agenda.
We'll leave it there. Secretary Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Dean.
Julie Sue is the acting U.S. Labor Secretary. She talked with Dean Kinetter earlier today after speaking at the Milwaukee Electrical Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee in Wauwatosa. And Monday on the morning show, be sure to catch a conversation with Vice President Kamala Harris as she visits the state. That is Monday after 7. Coming up, we hear how TV and movies can affect a child's social and emotional development with an expert from UW-Madison. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Verrett. Now, parents want to make sure their children aren't exposed to too many sad or scary things in movies or television so that the child doesn't develop emotional or mental health issues as a result. But at the same time, you don't want to shield children from all sad or scary things because that could prevent them from understanding how to process and manage those difficult emotions. So then, how much is the right amount? And what's the right way for children to experience these emotions in a safe and productive format? For example, the Disney movie The Lion King depicts the tragic death of the protagonist's father at the hands of his brother, Scar.
Scar! Brother! Help me!
Long live the king.
Such a powerful scene. The young lion cub Simba watches his father die, which you might think could be traumatizing to a child watching the movie. But throughout the film, you then see Simba work through those emotions and, spoiler alert, he avenges his father and he takes his place as the rightful king. The movie helps make it safe for the viewers to experience the difficult feelings and still make it through to happily ever after. Our next guest is an expert on the media's impact on child development, and she's here to help us with managing children's emotional growth. We want to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234. How do you see children process their emotions from television and movies? Was there a movie or show in your childhood that helped you access your emotions? And are there children's movies or shows that still make you emotional as an adult? Share your favorites with us. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Heather Kerkorian is the faculty director of the Child Development Lab and the department chair and professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. Heather, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Shereen. It's nice to be back.
So Disney movies like The Lion King often portray some sort of really upsetting tragedy that the characters eventually overcome. How do these stories help children with their emotional development?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is what makes for good TV and movies, right? Things that sort of bring up big emotions and sometimes spark tragedy and things like this. And I think for parents of really young kids, they try to shield young kids from that kind of information. And that makes sense in the earliest years. But one of the really wonderful things about media like TV and movies is they can be great launch pads for conversation. So as long as we've had humans living in groups, we've had storytelling as a great way to understand complex things, process big emotions, manage conflict. And TV and movies today are just the current version of that. So it can be a great launch pad for things that might be difficult to talk about.
How effective are children's shows and movies in supporting emotional development? Is it a real tool?
It can be. This is one of the areas where it depends a lot on how it's put together. And in the case of younger kids, it also depends a lot on how they're watching it. And in particular, if they're watching it with other people who help them understand what they're watching. So really, young kids aren't going to learn a lot from TV by itself. But if they're watching that show with someone else who helps them talk about that information and connect it to their own lives later, they'll get a lot more out of it.
How do you suggest we evaluate how well a specific story does this and how appropriate it might be for our own child?
Yeah, some of it will depend on individual kids. I think we all know we've had interactions with kids who are more sensitive or more confident with these kinds of things. So some of it is knowing that child as an individual, but some of it's also developmental. So how old is that child and how likely are they to be able to understand those concepts? For really young kids, they're going to be easily scared by things that look scary or violent, even if it's a good story, like a positive character doing a good thing. If it is really loud or looks scary, that can be really upsetting for them. So I usually recommend avoiding that kind of content for younger kids. For older kids, it's easier to show that kind of content and talk about it. for the littler set, I think the things we tend to look for social emotional development are things that mostly have positive depictions. We wouldn't want to use things, for example, that show a lot of negative antisocial behavior, even if there's a positive outcome in the end. Young kids are going to remember a lot of the antisocial behavior more than they'll remember the happy ending.
Mm. I'm curious about the flip side. What happens if children don't experience enough of these types of upsetting emotions? And maybe they're only exposed to happy, positive stories. Or what about the children who are exposed to no TV or movies at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know a lot about kids exposed to absolutely no TV and movies, partly because they're few and far between. Even when parents have the best intentions, often that's not the reality. And kids who have no exposure to screen media probably have a lot of things that are different in their lives. So it's hard to know how much that has to do with the absence of media exposure versus other things. There are certainly many other ways that kids can get access to social emotional lessons through school, through social interactions, peer interactions, parent-child interactions. So media is not the only place they can get this. So it's probably not what I would say is a critical resource. What I think is helpful is when kids encounter things like death and dying, for example, you gave the Lion King example. When kids encounter that in their real lives, it's going to be an emotionally upsetting moment for everyone in their lives. So media can be that kind of calmer, safer space to have these conversations so that kids are better armored to cope with those feelings when they do encounter them in real life.
One of the more modern examples of media teaching children about their emotions is this Disney, 2015 Disney movie Inside Out. Here's a clip from the movie when the character that represents the emotion of joy realizes that the young girl can't just have happy memories, but also needs to have sad ones too.
Sadness. Mom and Dad, the team, they came to help because of sadness.
How does that type of approach teach us about emotions directly?
Yeah, I love that movie for so many reasons. And one of them is the way that they've sort of taken really abstract concepts, things like emotion and memory, things that live in our heads that we can't necessarily see, and made them very visual and given them personalities. And I think that's a really wonderful way to make it something you can talk about with young kids. So making it visual and have personality. And I love this message in the clip that you played around the value of negative emotions, that negative emotions like sadness shouldn't be things we try to avoid. They're ways that we can get help, connect with each other. And so trying to avoid those negative feelings can actually be harmful and prevent us from getting the help that we need.
Can you expand on that a little bit more? I mean, how can we talk to our children about these stories? And what kinds of conversations should we be having to make sure that they're getting a well-rounded view of the world?
One of the really good things we can do, and media can be a great launchpad for this kind of conversation, is to check in with kids and ask how they're feeling, what they think about what they've seen. So if they see something scary or if they see something sad in a TV show or movie, we can ask them, how did that make you feel? How do you think that character felt? And that's a good way to start that conversation. Part of that just gives us, gives kids experience using emotion words, which is actually a really powerful way to learn how to identify and communicate their own emotions. It's just practicing that language and having words to put on it. So media can be a great resource for that. And then I think also being able to connect it to their own lives. So if we can say, oh, have you ever felt like that? Or how would you feel if that happened to you? It's a good way to help them relate to what they've seen in the media so that they can make use of what they're learning.
What are some of your favorite children's shows or movies, Heather, that you recommend, that you think are really helpful for working through our emotions? You mentioned that you really liked Inside Out. What are some other ones that we should think about?
Sure. Inside Out's a great one for movies, for older kids who can watch longer things. One of my favorites for younger kids, so Sesame Street is still the gold standard in a lot of ways. They continue to improve and research their content. So for younger kids, that's a great one. I still love Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, especially for social emotional lessons. I think it's done really well and gives parents really great tools that they can use in the real world to help kids replicate those lessons at home in their own lives.
Do you have any personal favorites from when you were a kid? I'm curious.
Oh, gosh, personal favorites for this. Mm-hmm. I was one of those really sensitive kids that got scared by a lot of things. That said, I mean, not for educational reasons at all, but my favorite movie from when I was a kid is The Last Unicorn.
I don't think I've even seen that. What? Well, I'm way older than
it's
you.
But, cult classic. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, and what about those that really stuck with you? I mean, this conversation made me think of Bambi. I mean, I can't think of Bambi without getting sad.
Yeah, Bambi really scared me when I was a kid. And I think for me, for really little kids, they might not understand the concept of loss and death and dying if they're really young. They might not quite understand what that means. But the visuals, like the fire, I remember really vividly. That was, I found really scary when I was a kid. And you can read the characters' expressions and understand that they're scared, even if you don't fully understand what's happening.
A lot of these shows are really, I mean, the shows that are really popular with kids, like Bluey. Why is that so popular?
Oh, that's a good one. I've actually thought about this one a lot. I mean, a lot of parents love Bluey, and I think that's partly because of the radical honesty about parenting. I really love that they have good humor and good depictions of some of the challenges of parenting, where, you know, parents aren't always perfect, and sometimes they get exasperated, and sometimes they find their children annoying, and that's just real, and that's parenting. So I think parents love it for that reason. I think the kids love it partly because it has very relatable kid characters. And it depicts a lot of everyday scenarios that kids are used to seeing in their own lives. So I think they find it very relatable.
How difficult is it for parents to really help your children process emotions when you don't have control over what movies or TV children watch all the time? I mean, they're at a friend's house or whatever, and they come home and they talk about something that they saw, and you're like, what? I mean, how do you approach that?
Indeed. Yeah. This is one of the reasons I think it's good to watch things together and talk about them, because trying to minimize any exposure to potentially harmful content might work for a little while, but eventually they're going to see it or hear about it through peers at school in some other way. So I think it's good to have these conversations with kids early and often. So they know they can talk about it, because they probably will encounter it at some point.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Shireen. Great to talk with you.
Heather Kerkorian is the faculty director of the Child Development Lab and the department chair and professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. She was with us today discussing how children's TV shows and movies affect emotional development. I'm Shireen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shireen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Now, the snow has arrived and winter is truly upon us here in Wisconsin. It is the perfect time to make hearty, warming dishes. Today on Food Friday, we're celebrating the art of braising, cooking meats and vegetables low and slow. Our next guest recently showcased his cooking chops on Food Network. He's here to talk about his experience representing Wisconsin on the national stage and teach us how to perfect our braising technique to create one pot wonders from the comfort of home. You can join in too. 800-642-1234. Tell us, what are your favorite meats and vegetables to braise during the winter season? Do you have a one-pot recipe you keep coming back to? What questions do you have about taking your braising game to the next level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dan Fox is the chef and owner of Heritage Tavern in Madison and the Fox Heritage Farms and Willow Creek Farms. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being
here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You competed on Food Network on Chopped, and the episode aired last month. For people who haven't ever seen the show, what is the premise and what was the experience like?
Well, I'm sure most folks out there now are somewhat familiar with reality TV and the premise around reality cooking shows. You know, they bring in professionals in their industries, in the cooking industry, and you go on, and there's many different shows like this. But Chopped is kind of unique in the sense that the name Chopped, there's four contestants, and three of which get chopped, or, you know, they don't make it till the finish, the final. And it's one person that doesn't get chopped at the end. So I was lucky enough to compete, like you mentioned, about a month ago. And you can find that online if you just Google Chopped. It was actually a really amazing episode, all focused around Julia Child. Julia Child being such an iconic food figure. I am very fond of Julia. I used to watch Julia Child as a kid, you know, sitting on the couch, flipping, you know, surfing through. I was back when there was just regular TV.
Yeah.
And, you know, not those fancy stuff. So you'd see Julia pop up, and that was one of the reasons why they chose me to be, they actually reached out to me to choose me to be on the show, because I have a kind of a Julia Child background. And I'm classically French trained, which really leans into one of, you know, a lot of Julia's specialties. So this Chopped reality food TV show, there was a series. So it was 16 contestants. And if you won the first round, you moved on to the second one. So it was actually 2 days of filming. And the each round, you get four mystery. It's a mystery basket for each round. And it starts out with an appetizer and then an entree and then dessert. And the thing about Chopped, for the appetizer, it's only 20 minutes that you have to prepare this item. So you have to prepare a whole dish in 20 minutes. And you really don't know what the ingredients are going to be beforehand. Of course, this being a Julia Child themed show, they, you know, the first one was French onion soup, and the ingredients they gave me were veal ossobuco, or raw veal shanks, mm-hmm. A blooming onion, a day-old blooming onion from like TGI Fridays.
Okay.
And some random fancy French onions, and the last ingredient, I think it was like champagne or something. And you have to create an appetizer out of these four ingredients. And then there's like a pantry of items that you get to go rummage through. And it's pretty chaotic.
A lot of pressure. Yeah.
A lot of pressure. Yeah. And everything, it's, you really don't have very much time. It's like just minutes before you see the mystery basket items and you have to go. So yeah, it brings out a lot of anxiety, and there's cameras everywhere. And it was a lot of fun.
What was your,
it was quite the experience.
What was your biggest takeaway? I mean, what did you love the most about it?
You know what? As I mentioned, I'm classically French trained, and I'm kind of from the old school French era of, you know, you kind of got yelled at and long, grueling hours, and it was not the most fun job. It was the most glamorous job. You know, the kitchens have definitely evolved now. But I tend to take myself a little bit too seriously in the kitchen. And you can kind of see in the episode, and the judges were bouncing off, you know, in conversation with me that, yo, you take yourself so seriously. Serious, you know, and one of the Julia Child's biggest thing is just to remember to have fun in the kitchen, that you're going to make mistakes. It's the love of cooking, and to not forget that. So that was something you can almost kind of forget when you've been doing it as long as I have.
Well, Dan, it sounds very cool. Still, though, like we said, a lot of pressure. So instead of just taking 20 or 30 minutes to make a dish, we're going to slow down the pace a little bit and talk about a little bit more relaxed method of cooking, braising. So explain, what exactly is braising, and what do you love about it?
Braising is a very low and slow cooking method, and I think it's really amazing for this time. It always reminds me of very comforting. When you walk into a home or wake up in the morning and someone's cooking, and whatever they're cooking is perfumed throughout the entire house. And as the day goes on, that smell just matures, and it really, that the idea of the one pot wonder is really where my heart lies with cooking. So combining a lot of hearty ingredients and having that low process, and that the meats and how the maturity of flavors with the meats as that low, slow braising method is really amazing.
Well, what are the best meats to use? I mean, is there a specific cut of meat that you recommend for braising over anything else?
I mean, pork shoulder is an amazing cut to braise. We actually raise heritage pigs. It's kind of something that we're known for. So one of my favorite cuts is the Boston butt. It's the top of the pork shoulder from really well-raised animals, or the shoulder of beef the same. It's a lot of marbling of a lot of connective tissue, a lot of development of flavor as it cooks and breaks down.
So when it's time to braise something, how do you pick the right temperature and the right length of time for the meat that you've chosen? Is there some kind of crazy math to it, or?
There is. It's a little bit more. The nice thing is if you're cooking a larger cut of meat, and when I say larger, maybe like a 2 or 3 pounds piece, like let's just envision a 2 pounds piece of pork shoulder, or let's say it's a 2 pound piece of beef short rib. We can kind of compare those two. And you would cook it at low temperature. So you're pretty much your very quick synopsis of it. You sear meat, sear some vegetables, and go as in depth as someone wants. Deglaze, we typically hit when the pan's really hot. There's all those little caramely bits at the bottom. Hit with some like red wine, maybe some tomato paste, and then a really flavorful stock, like canned broth or something is just fine. And the seared meat, seared vegetables, the broth, the tomato paste, wine. And you set the temperature to about 190 to 200, maybe not quite 300 degrees. Mm-hmm. And depending on how low you have it, the margin of error grows. So you can overcook or be on the side of overcooking by a half hour to an hour. So it really, it's not as stressful as like searing a steak maybe.
Okay.
To the temperature.
Okay. Well, talk to me about the browning and searing before starting the braise. Why is that important? What does it accomplish?
So it's really development of flavor, that Maillard reaction, that caramelization. That's same as like grilling a piece of meat. It develops. It's a lot more flavor. So getting that deep. It's more of like a medium to medium high heat, maybe medium heat. And really, when you put a piece of meat in the pan, it needs to sizzle. Not like smoking, but a little smoke is, don't be afraid of some smoke in the pan and get a nice little sear on there. And you want it to kind of be a deeper sear, not just like a shallow sear on it, the piece of meat. And you'll do that on all four sides or three sides or six sides or whatever your piece of meat looks like. And at that point in time, you can remove the piece of meat out of the pan and put your vegetables in, or you can put the vegetables in along with the piece of meat and caramelize those as well. Depending on how big your pan is, you never really want to crowd. So it's selecting the right pan or pots, rondo or whatever, cast iron, La Crusade, rondo type pan, or a slow cooker, that's more deep walled pan. So you can have a liquid that comes up. And the thought process is a third to a quarter of the piece of meat is showing. So you'd want to have that much surface area in your pan. So nonetheless, you see the piece of meat, see the vegetables. And then when you that caramelization, that fond, we call it, on the bottom of the pan, there's all those little caramely bits. And it's caramelized meats like onions or garlic or tomatoes, you know, whatever you put in there. And then when you want to hit that with red wine or white wine, depending on what direction you're going with your dish, and that really that acid and fruity flavor of the wine, along with maybe some tomato products, it really adds a really nice depth of flavor and roundness. And then you put in that flavorful stock up to about two-thirds, three-quarters, and then put a lid on it, and you're good to go, depending on what temperature it is and how big the piece of meat is and whatnot for cooking time.
Can I ask you about cooking oils? We have this debate at home. What's the best cooking oil to use when you're searing meat? Should you use vegetable oil, coconut oil, olive oil? What's the difference and why does it matter?
Well, coconut oil, I think, is an amazing oil. I think it's a really underutilized oil. The fat of coconuts, has a lot of health benefits, along with avocado oil. Of course, like olive oil, they're higher in monounsaturated fats. Avocado oil is a fantastic fantastic oil. And all of those have high smoke points. They have high, you can heat them up to like 400, 500 degrees in some of them. And they call it a smoke point, and it doesn't burn the oil. For instance, if you use extra virgin olive oil, it typically will tell you, even though being a great fat, great oil for you, as soon as you heat it up too much, it really ruins the properties and the light, delicate flavors of extra virgin olive oil. Typically, it's like finishing oil. But those oils, you mentioned the coconut oil, avocado oil, sure, olive oil, vegetable oil, canola oil, those are all fine. But I typically reach, if I'm cooking especially for myself, like a nicer oil for you, healthier oil.
That's good to know. And I always forget about avocado oil as being even a choice. That's not something that I think about very often, because we hear about extra virgin olive oil all the time. I feel like that's where, you know, it's in our face. But yeah.
Yeah. And just a sorry, just quick note on those. Yeah. I always label read on the avocado oils or even olive oils in general. And I always look for something, the monounsaturated fat. I think that's a really important point, a key thing there, because not all of them, just because it is an avocado oil or olive oil doesn't mean that it's necessarily higher in monounsaturated fat. That's really what you're looking for. So that's typically how I choose my oil.
All right. Thanks for that. Dan Fox is the chef and owner of Heritage Tavern in Madison with us today for a Food Friday conversation about the wide world of braising. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a family recipe for something that cooks on the stove all day? What are your tried and true slow cooker tips? Do you have a favorite braised dish at a local restaurant and wonder how they do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk with Dan Fox, chef and owner of Heritage Tavern in Madison. He's here to share how we can braise meats and vegetables like a pro this winter season. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guest, call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. What about braising vegetables? Do you do much of that?
Sure, absolutely. I think 'tis the season for root vegetables, cabbage or Brussels sprouts, and all of those following a very similar process that you would for meat. It's a much less cooking time, of course. And yeah, I think it's a great utilization of seasonal vegetables right now.
So by themselves, I mean, do you just make vegetable dishes by themselves, braise them? Is that something that that's worth doing?
For sure. Like featuring the vegetable as the main dish, like the entree almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We actually do that at our restaurant, Heritage Tavern, downtown Madison. We have a really lovely braised cabbage dish. We get some it's a local arrowhead cabbage from a local farm. And we take that just the same. We have a nice wedge that we sear. It's a pretty creative mixture. My sous chef, her name is Cookie. She came up with this recipe. Seared it off, deglazed with, so again, that's when the pan's nice and hot and there's that caramelization that happens. And you get those little, that we call it fond, or little bits that caramelize the pans. The pan, you want to take advantage of that flavor, and we will hit a splash of white wine, and I think we're actually putting a little bit of mirin in as well, so rice wine. Nonetheless, then you want to reduce that down, and the French term for it is called à sec, and that means almost dry or just about dry, where you have a little, the smallest amount of that liquid left, and that's pretty much almost reduced down, and then you add in a broth of some kind. Typically with meat, it'll be a meat stock of some kinds. And with a vegetable, you could be pretty creative there. You know, you could do a heavy tomato-driven broth, or you could do more of like a vegetable broth or a vegetable stock. Mm-hmm. We actually make a very specific vegetable stock for this dish, and then we will cook it very low and slow until when you pierce it with a knife, it comes out almost effortlessly. That's kind of the general idea with braising. That mm-hmm. means it's pretty much done, whether it's meat or vegetable. Then you let it cool down in that liquid. That's a really important step.
Okay.
And once it cools down in the liquid, you remove the meat or the vegetable out, and then you reduce that liquid down. We reduce down the cabbage liquid and the white wine. And then we mount some butter in there, and then we put a little gratin. And this is at the restaurant. In the salamander, we gratin that up a little bit with some cheese, and then put it back on the plate, and then use that braising liquid that we reduced down to create the sauce for the dish. Really important step. There's a ton of flavors in that broth. And then we put a little rye crumble on top and some other garnishes, and it's an entree at our restaurant. All vegetable driven.
It sounds delicious. We want to hear really what listeners think, too. If you have a question for our guest, 800-642-1234. Dan's happy to answer those. 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm glad you brought up the broth thing because I wanted to ask you, a lot of people use broth and stock kind of interchangeably. What's the difference between them and when is one preferred over the other?
Well, a broth, for me, is just kind of a thinner version, like of a stock. So the stock that I like to use is whatever I'm cooking. I typically like that to be the stock that I'm using. So if it's like chicken thighs, for example, I use a chicken stock. Or for pork shoulder, I use a pork stock. And the same for beef, and on and on. And then for vegetables, like I mentioned, you can be a little bit more creative. Or for that matter, with meat, you know, there's milk braised pork shoulder. You have a lot of Italian dishes or other ethnic dishes that braise heavily in tomato. People will put dried fruits in. So when that broth or the liquid, you can really be pretty creative with that seasoning, and that can be a whole world all to its own. How to create really in-depth flavors there.
How much liquid should be in the mix here? I've heard that too much liquid is wrong.
Too much liquid is not great. It's the more liquid you have, the more flavor from the meat is dispersed in the liquid. And if there's too much, it can almost taste a little bland. And you really have to reduce down that liquid a lot more. In the general rule that I like to use is when you put in your, whether it's vegetables or meats, you'll just have just a little bit, maybe like an inch, 3 inches, depending on how big the piece of meat is, above the liquid surface. Mm-hmm. So you just have a little bit of exposed meat, and then typically would put a piece of parchment paper on top and then cover it with tinfoil or a lid. And and you want to bring that liquid up to a boil before you put it in the oven. That's kind of another important step.
Okay. Well, we've got about 3 minutes left. Let's go to Dale from Stevens Point. Hi, Dale. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Quick question about sous vide and braising, the order that you would do that in, and any handy tips. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Dale.
For sous vide. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I heard.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's really amazing. I'm glad you brought that up. That sous vide really opens the window of opportunities for especially developing flavor and lowering that margin of error. You can almost – it's a little more foolproof doing the sous vide method. People that aren't familiar with sous vide, it's reduced oxygen packaging, and you can have a little machine that sucks all the air out of the bag. You put the piece of meat, typically you want to sear the piece of meat. So you really want to take the same steps that you would for a normal braise and put all of that in a bag. The liquid that you put in, the stock, the wine, the tomato, all that liquid, typically I want that to be a little bit more flavorful than I would maybe in a normal braise. I really want to make sure that adds a nice packs a punch. I would just be careful on your salt content. That sous vide can amplify the amount of salt by a little bit, so just be careful there, whether it's soy sauce or the types of salt. And if someone's already sous videing or familiar with sous vide, you would, of course, know that after you sear your vegetables, your meat, and your broth, that all needs to go into the bag cold. It's a very important step. If you put hot anything in a sous vide bag, typically, at least for me, it's always exploded in the machine and created a big mess. So, yeah, you really want to cool everything down. Put everything in the bag, and then you put it into a water bath. Anyone who's sous videing should probably know this step as well. But the next step is to cook in a water bath. You typically have a some kind of immersion circulator, they're called, or it's a temperature-controlled unit that you slide down into a water bath. You could also create a water bath on your stovetop or in your oven. Really what it is creating a consistent heat temperature of water, whether it's maybe a typical temperature might be 190 degrees or something like that. You want that to stay at like 190 degrees the entire time it's cooking, and it lengthens the cooking time. As long as you're above, 140, 150 degrees, You can even flirt with going a little bit lower temperature. I shouldn't be necessarily telling you unless you really know what you're doing. But you can actually extend the cooking time a lot longer for like days almost.
Okay.
I don't recommend that for anyone at home. But if you're really curious, you know, that is the idea. Or maybe let's just say for the entire day.
Okay.
And it's really interesting, like if you do a short rib.
It sounds great. And Dan, I'm sorry, that is all the time we have. But now I'm super hungry. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been great.
Yeah, this was really fun. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Dan Fox is the chef and owner of Heritage Tavern in Madison and the Fox Heritage Farms and Willow Creek Farms. He joined us for Food Friday for a behind-the-scenes look at his time on a national food competition show and a crash course in Braising 101, or how to create hearty, warming one-pot dishes at home. On Thursday, we heard a conversation with British podcaster Giles Brandreth about childhood memories. It was a discussion that sparked quite a few phone calls from listeners who talked about their own first recollections. That conversation got me thinking about whether there are actual benefits to remembering those happy experiences from our youth, and it turns out that is indeed the case. The American Psychological Association says people who have fond memories of their childhood tend to have better health, less depression, and fewer chronic illnesses as adults. Memory plays a huge part in how we make sense of the world, from how we view ourselves to how we judge others. My children are grown up now, but it's a good reminder that we all play a vital role in creating great memories. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Now, just before Christmas, if you can remember back to last year, the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down our state's legislative district maps. And in asking for new maps to be submitted for review, the justices included some criteria based on constitutional requirements for compactness, similar-sized populations, and physical connection. Another factor they want to consider, quote, partisan impact, as the old maps were widely considered unfairly favorable to Republicans. Well, a week ago, the court received seven sets of Assembly and Senate maps, and our next guest has spent a lot of time with all of them, including running them through a computer program to do some comparisons with the results of the 2022 election and getting an idea for how competitive districts could become if any of these would ultimately be adopted. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the process of Wisconsin getting new legislative maps? Are you excited by all of this or frustrated? What kind of impact do you think new maps could have on the legislative races in Wisconsin this year? What about on the national election? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. John Johnson is a research fellow in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University, where he specializes in applying research practices from academia and data science to policy issues facing Milwaukee and Wisconsin. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us now why the current court decided that the maps are unconstitutional. What was the premise?
The court ruled that the existing maps were unconstitutional because they were not physically contiguous. Previously, for at least some period of time, courts had interpreted the contiguity requirement a little more loosely, and this court decided that no literal physical contiguity was required for Assembly and Senate districts. Because many of the districts were not fully contiguous, they ruled that an entirely new map would be needed.
So the court requested map submissions, but who ultimately will be responsible for adopting them? Is that still in the hands of the legislature and the governor? How does it work?
The court is clear that the legislature still has the authority to draw new maps. If they can draw maps that are signed into law by the governor before the deadline to implement new maps ahead of the August partisan primary, then those will be the new maps for the state. The court has said that if the legislature fails to do that, then the court will choose a remedial map to implement.
How likely a scenario do you think that is, that the court will actually wind up being the decision maker?
I have not met a single person who thinks it's likely that the legislature and governor will agree on new maps.
That's interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about the criteria that the justices set for map submissions that they argue are in line with the state constitution. So what is the criteria?
Well, districts need to have equal populations. That's the whole point of redistricting. Obviously, they've got to be contiguous. We just had a whole long court case about that. They need to follow federal civil rights law around creating the right number of minority opportunity districts, which in Wisconsin is limited to the city of Milwaukee. The court has said that they will prefer plans that split fewer municipalities, counties, and wards than plans which split more of them, all else being equal. Compactness is a requirement that's in the state constitution, although it's not defined. And then most significantly, perhaps, the court said that they would consider the partisan impact of any plan that was before them.
So let's talk about that, the partisan impact. The justices left kind of this whole thing open-ended as to how they're going to evaluate that. Do you have a sense of how they will evaluate that? And I mean, I guess, does it leave the door open to the ways that we could go about measuring the new maps to assess them for that?
You're right. They weren't specific in what they meant by this, but I think most people think that what they mean is they want a map that translates whichever party gets a majority of the support in the state to the party that gets a majority of the seats in the legislature.
So let's talk about your research. How did you set out to measure partisan impact in your scoring of the
map? There's so many ways that you can measure that. What I chose to do is to come up with a statistical model that says how the 2022 election that most of us can remember, how that probably would have happened if it had been held under one of these proposed maps. So you can't just add up the vote for state legislative Republican and Democratic candidates because so many of those seats weren't contested by both parties. So instead, I used a pretty simple statistical model that took the results of the governor's race, the U.S. Senate race, the state treasurer, and the attorney general's races, and use those to predict what the vote in the assembly or state Senate district would have been. As it turns out, in 2022, as has been common in Wisconsin, state legislative Republican candidates did quite a bit better than statewide Republican candidates in general did. So, you know, that model of the 2022 election actually thinks that in the way votes were cast then, Republicans would have been likely to win a majority of the vote for the state legislature and a majority of the seats, at least a one-seat majority across all of these plans. However, Governor Evers himself won a majority of the seats in all of the plans that were submitted by Democratic or liberal-aligned petitioners. So you can see how this creates a much more competitive map. Under the old map, we often said, well, it would take a Tammy Baldwin in 2018-sized swing across the state. Every Democrat running all over the state would need to be as popular as Tammy Baldwin in 2018 was. She had, I think, an 11-point margin of victory for them to have a shot at getting a majority under the old maps. Under most of these proposed new maps, it would take a Tony Evers-sized victory. Close to that would deliver the legislature to Democrats.
In your research, did anything surprise you? Did anything jump out at you as something that you were not expecting to see?
One thing I think is pretty interesting is that across all of those neutral criteria that I talked about, compactness, splits, contiguity, majority-minority districts, those kinds of things, two plans, well, there's no one plan that does best on each metric, but there's two plans that do really pretty good across those, and they're the plans by Will, the conservative law firm in Wisconsin, and by Law Forward, the progressive law firm in Wisconsin. And those two groups achieve very different partisan outcomes, as you'd expect in the maps that they draw, but they actually look pretty similar across those other criteria. So I think that is a demonstration of the way that partisan intent can play a huge role in these maps.
Where else did these map submissions come from? So Will submitted one. The progressive law firm submitted another. Where did the rest of them come from?
The legislative Republicans submitted one. A group of Democratic state senators provided their preferred plan. Governor Evers put forward a plan. A group called the Right Petitioners put forward a plan with the help of some Democratic-aligned law firms. And a professor in Milwaukee named Matthew Petering put forward a plan, but the court ultimately decided not to consider his plan. They ruled that this week because he was not one of the original petitioners who were part of the case.
And are they all very, very different from one another?
You can kind of put them into two groups. The legislative Republicans plan and the Will plan are the two plans that favor Republicans noticeably, although the Will plan creates far fewer safe Republican seats than the legislative Republicans map does. And then the other plans are all clearly trying to create a map with closer to a 50-50 balance between Democrats and Republicans.
How likely do you think it'll be that we will get close to a 50-50 balance once all is said and done?
When one of those plans is chosen, if one of the plans put forward by these Democratic-aligned petitioners is chosen, I think that will create a scenario where both parties will believe that they have a chance to win a majority. So I was talking about the 2022 election and trying to model those results. I think it's an interesting thought experiment to imagine how 2024 will be different. Of course, the electorate will be larger in a presidential year. It's not entirely clear which party that benefits. In the past, usually Democrats, but we've seen some possibility that has changed in the Trump era. But also, I think under a more competitive state assembly map, it's possible that Democrats will field higher quality candidates and fund their campaigns to a higher level. So that gap that we've seen in the past between state legislative Democratic performance and statewide Democratic candidate performance, maybe that gap will narrow somewhat. I'm not sure, though. It's hard to predict the future.
Yeah. We're talking about submissions for new legislative maps in Wisconsin with John Johnson. He is a research fellow in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University. We'd love to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about new Wisconsin legislative maps with John Johnson from Marquette. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'd love for you to go back a little bit to the research you did and how the results of the 2022 election would have looked different under some of these different maps. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So in the plan that the legislative Republicans put forward, the partisan balance would have been the same. 64 Republican seats, most likely 35 for Democrats is what my model predicts. Under the plan put forward by Will, that drops to 60 Republican seats out of the 99. And under the other plans, the number of Democratic seats ranges from 46 to 49. Again, 50 making up a majority. Although it's, you know, I do want to note that Governor Evers himself did win a majority of the seats under most of those Democratic submitted plans. Actually, I think all of them. The fact that my model shows Republicans possibly hanging on to a majority in a year like 2022 is because of the way that their legislative candidates have usually punched above their weight, I guess you could say, in those local races.
It's important to note you're not predicting anything for 2024, but how do you think your scorecards for these different submissions could give people food for thought to imagine how that election could be different than the midterms?
The way I like to say it is think in your own mind about how you think 2024 will be different, how much of an advantage, if you think it will help Democrats, that will be. And, you know, add those percentage points to the numbers that we see from 2022. Often, you know, political scientists talk about uniform swings happening. If one part of the state moves towards the Democrats, it's likely that the other parts will move towards the state in a similar way. That doesn't always happen. Sometimes places move in different directions. We've seen a lot of that happen since 2016 in, you know, the suburbs and rural areas and things like that. But in general, the sort of political environment moves either better for Republicans or better for Democrats. And so if you think 2024 is going to be a good year for Democrats, then, well, I bet a Democrat would be pretty excited about five of these maps at least.
Hmm. How much more competitive could we stand to see these districts get? I mean, obviously, it depends on which maps we end up with. But it sounds like there's, you know, it's not going to take away the majorities that we see, but narrow them.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that in a good year for Democrats, I think it would deliver majority control of the assembly to them. And in fact, even using the results from the 2022 election, two of the submitted plans suggest that in elections like that, the Senate would actually tilt Democratic. Of course, the state Senate takes two election cycles to entirely turn over, so it may take more time to see those changes come into effect.
What do you think? I mean, is it a good thing to have more competitive districts than what we have now? What do you think?
Over the last decade, under the old maps, I think the number of incumbents who lost re-election you could count on one hand. It scarcely ever happened. And I think a situation where legislators aren't worried about losing their election, who feel like they have it locked up almost no matter what they do in office, that doesn't seem good for democracy to me.
Do you think that's tied to the maps, though? Or do you think it's more because incumbents are hard to beat?
Incumbents are hard to beat, but the edge is only worth a couple points. You can measure it here in Wisconsin. So, you know, it's partly because incumbents have an advantage, but more so because there's very few competitive seats under the current map. Very few at all where either party has a chance of winning. And so these new maps, most of them create far more competitive seats. They create a number of seats where Ron Johnson carried a majority of the vote and Governor Evers at the same time in the 2022 election. And to me, that's sort of the essence of a tipping point seat.
I'm curious about Wisconsin compared to other states. We've heard before that Wisconsin is the most, if not, or one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. Why is that? I mean, how did we get here in the first place?
Well, redistricting in the way we know it today began in the 1960s after the Baker versus Carr decision required that legislative districts have equal populations. And since then, the courts have usually drawn the map in Wisconsin because it's been uncommon for a state legislature and governor to agree. Now, 2011 was one of those times when we actually had both chambers of the legislature and the governor controlled by one party, in that case, the Republicans. And so they were able to draw a remarkably successful gerrymander. And gerrymandering has become more powerful because we're able to draw maps more efficiently using the computing power that's now available, and also, perhaps even more importantly, because voters themselves are far more predictable. It was much harder to draw a gerrymander 20 or 30 years ago because voters would frequently split their tickets between Democrats and Republicans, and they might have been more likely to change their preferred party from one cycle to another. Today, that happens far less frequently, so voter behavior is far more predictable.
What are you going to be watching for after MAPS consultants submit their final reviews of the submissions to the courts?
I'll be curious to see if the Supreme Court, on the advice of their consultants, finds that one of these MAPS does what they're looking for, or if they'll, for some reason, be dissatisfied with all of them. I suppose they could ask their consultants to provide a plan of their own. That's the kind of work that the consultants they've hired have done in other states.
How quickly is all of this going to happen? What's the process, and what's the timeline looking like?
according to the Wisconsin Election Commission, they need to know for sure what the final districts will be by mid-March. The deadline here is really the partisan primary in August. Candidates need to know far before the primary which district they live in so they can decide if they want to run or not, and then whose signatures they need to collect to get on the ballot.
What do you think about that timeline? Is it realistic?
It's basically what we had to do 2 years ago. The census was delayed by the pandemic, and so that data came out later than expected, and then there was litigation, and so the final districts weren't determined in Wisconsin until, I believe, March of 2022. Now, one of the criteria that the court has asked for is that plans avoid splitting wards as much as possible. And so that's something that I think should make lives a little easier for local elections administrators. They'll have to take account of the new districts, but hopefully they won't have to change the actual units at which they administer elections very much.
How come that request was made to not split the wards?
It's a part of the traditional redistricting criteria is an idea that maps should respect ward boundaries. Of course, based on a legal change about a decade ago in Wisconsin, now the final versions of wards are drawn after the districts are made. So it's not a hard and fast requirement, but it's definitely a best practice. And especially when you have a shortened deadline like this for getting new maps into place, anything you can do to make the logistics easier for the people who are actually administering the elections is a good thing.
Is there skepticism that any map will ever be fair in Wisconsin? I feel like I hear that from people. What is your sense?
Well, it's hard to know what fair means, right? Some people think a fair map is one that you draw without paying any attention to partisan outcomes, when you just follow these more neutral redistricting criteria. And it's clear that these maps, most of them at least, don't do that, that they're thinking explicitly about partisan balance. And that is indeed how the court said they would measure them. So another concept of fairness in maps is that you should explicitly try to create a map where the party that gets most of the votes will most likely get most of the seats. So I think you have competing definitions of fairness. And for those who hold to one definition, they'll just not be satisfied by the other.
Well, John, I want to thank you for sharing your work with us today. It's fascinating.
Thank you.
John Johnson is research fellow in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University. We spoke with him today about the various submissions of the new legislative maps for the Wisconsin Supreme Court to consider as it weighs replacing our current maps. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the Justice Department released its analysis of the horrific school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, which raises questions about the police response. We'll hear from a criminologist and expert on mass shootings for perspective. That is coming up Monday here on Central Time.